Hi there, I'm Dr. Trevor Cates. Welcome to the Spa Doctor Podcast. Have you ever wondered what it would take to live to be over 100 years old and be healthy and happy? That's exactly what we're talking about on today's podcast. We want to not only have longevity, but quality of life also. So my guest today is Dr. Mario Martinez. He is a clinical neuropsychologist who specializes in how cultural beliefs affect health and longevity. He proposes, based upon credible research evidence, that longevity is learned and the causes of health are inherited. He has studied healthy centenarians worldwide and found that only 20 to 25% can be attributed to genetics. The rest is related to how they live and the cultural beliefs they share. He is author of the best-selling book, The Mind-Body Code, How to Change the Beliefs That Limit Your Health, Longevity, and Success. In addition to longevity, he also explains why our immune system is not just a protector. Instead, it responds to the cultural premises we learn to perceive the world. In this interview, we talk about how to live a healthy, long life, which behaviors, thought patterns, lifestyle choices hold us back, and which ones help us. I really enjoyed interviewing Mario, and I hope you enjoy this discussion as much as I did. Mario, it's so great to have you on my podcast.
Thank you. Finally, we get together. It's been a while.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, I know you've done a lot of really interesting research, and I'm excited to delve into this today. I love the study of looking at longevity and what helps us with that, and what are the key factors. So I know you've studied a lot of centenarians, right? So tell us about what got you interested in this in the first place.
I'm a clinical neuropsychologist. We studied how the brain, when the brain, there's pathology, what the deficit is, the cognitive and the physical and so forth. So we knew a lot about the pathology of the brain, but not about how the brain works when it's at maximum health. Same thing with longevity. We study gerontology as if it's a deteriorating process because we borrowed a model from physics to make biology more acceptable. And we are closed systems. We are self-organizing, and the model of Newtonian physics doesn't work really well because the entropy is like we go from order to disorder. So the thinking is that as you grow older, you get more disordered and more disabled. Well, the model that I use is a model of complexity, which says that for closed systems that are alive, you go from simple to complex. So as you grow older, you become more complex. The brain becomes more complex. So then I wanted to, you know, good science looks at what works and then creates theories to see if it works. So what works is centenarians who are healthy, people who are over 100 and are healthy. So again, with my reductionist training, I thought I was going to find genetics. I thought it was genetics. And I thought, well, if you have good genetics, and they talk about the Methuselah gene and all of that, which is really not good science. I found that genetics only accounts for about 20 to 25% at most. The rest is what I call biocultural, the way that we live, not even what you eat. What you eat is important, but these people, some eat meat, some don't. So it's really a biocultural assimilation that allows you to live longer. I interviewed a Zen master in L.A. who was 107. And I asked him, I always try to get the anthropological part. I said, well, when did your parents die? And he gave me the typical Zen answer. He said, my parents will die when I die. But I asked his assistant, I'm like, please tell me, when did his parents pass away? So the father at 70 and the mother at 75, and he was 107. Now, the genetics helps. It doesn't hurt if you have good genetics, but it's not sufficient to actually account for the healthy centenarians. So that's basically what I came up with, which is totally incompatible with what we were expecting from conventional science. Gerontology studies the pathology of aging. I study the health of growing older. It's totally different. What are the causes of health as you grow older?
Right. And so what are the things that make a big impact on longevity? And you know, we want to live long, but we also want to have quality of life, right? So exactly. What are the things that help us have that quality of life rather than just technology that keeps us alive?
That's right. That's a good point. I didn't study centenarians who were in nursing homes vegetating or sick. I didn't study those because, as you said, what's the point of living without quality of life? So what I found first is that culture has a lot to do with our longevity, the perception that we have of our culture. And even the immune system responds to our culture, the brain responds to our culture, which I'll explain if you want me to. But what centenarians do is that they have a, I had to create a theory to explain what they do. So the theory is that we have portals, what I call portals, that are cultural portals, and the society will put you in those portals, like newborn, child, adolescent, young adult, middle age especially as a marker, but it's cultural. Then elderly, and then you're dead. So each portal is determined by what the culture tells you. If you want to retire in Turkey, you can retire at 45. In Australia, you have to wait till you're 75. The middle age marker is the most important component of how you're going to look. Ellen Langer, my colleague at Harvard, has done a lot of work in the area similar to I have, what how context affects the longevity and also the biology. And she looked at people that look significantly younger and people that look significantly older than their age. And after she factored out all the other factors that could be contributing, the main contributing factor was when you thought middle age started. The ones who looked significantly younger thought that it started 10 to 15 years later. So now, if you want to believe in middle age, I would say it starts at 90. Just to have a marker, that's if you want to buy that. But that's those are the things, and it's just a cultural component, because when we created consciousness, the immune system had to pay attention to the consciousness. And when you're born, you have a physiology, and when you're hungry, there's the hormonal, as you know, all kinds of things going on. And then when you see a breast or you see a bottle, and you satiate that hunger, that also changes your biology or psychoneuroimmunology. There's no language for it, but we're designed to pay attention to what I call the culture editors. These are the people that cultures give them a lot of power. A mother at home, feeding a child, a doctor at a clinic, clergy at a church, and so forth. So we're designed to pay attention from day one. Then you pay attention to that, and it has a major component of survival. Later, you find out, oh, that's a breast, that's a bottle, that's my mother. You give it a symbol, but that symbol becomes biosymbol already because it has a biology. So that's why the immune system has to respond to our symbols. For example, if you shame somebody, the person will have inflammation. You have molecules of inflammation that are secreted when you shame somebody. A word, shaming, but only it depends on the culture. If you shame somebody in this culture, they take it personal and they have interleukins and tumor necrosis factors released as if there were a pathogen. But if you tried to shame someone in Asia, for example, they would only have a shaming effect if they perceive that you're shaming their family, their group, or their country, not the individual. So it's very collective. But that's all culture, not physiological in a sense.
So what are,
So
that's really fascinating. What are the some of the things that people do in the US that are negatively impacting our ability to live a healthy long life? Like culturally, what are
the
we doing?
creation of, yeah, the creation of the I self, what I call the I self. We have an identity where we take our iPads for lunch and our Mac for dinner. And as you know, our physiology is not made for that. We have a sympathetic and parasympathetic system for eating and for working. And you can't mix the two. I work with a lot of Fortune 100 companies, and 75% of their executives have gastrointestinal problems because that's what they taught the I self. To go from parasympathetic to sympathetic, and it doesn't work. So there's a learning of an illness. Acquired illnesses have a learning process, and so in this country we overprescribe antidepressant medication. Now we know pretty much that serotonin is really not necessarily the model. It's not serotonin. It's really inflammation. But also we don't let people mourn. Your mother dies and you get depressed and you're given an antidepressant. Well, we have 150,000 years of trial and error of how to do our mourning. But if you take that away from a person, then what you're doing is you're creating a plastic self that doesn't allow what the system knows what to do really well. And sometimes people need antidepressants, but this country prescribes more antidepressants than any other country in the world. France, liver medication, everything's a liver. And in Germany, heart. In the UK, gastrointestinal. So even medicine has a propensity to be cultural in that sense.
Interesting. And why do you think that is?
Well, because everything is cultural and medicine is cultural. And if you have a doctor in Cuba, he would say, have an espresso and a cigar, even though he's a doctor. And if you have a doctor somewhere else, he'll say, have some yogurt. And so it's a there are universals, no question. If you have an infection, you need an antibiotic. But if you have an antibiotic here for an infection in the US, your perception is this is a pathogen, this is some bacteria or something, and you need. But if you go to the Amazon and the shaman says, yes, you have an infection, but you have a malignant spirit that has gone in through that infection. So you're going to need a lot more antibiotic because your body's already set up for a nocebo effect, and the antibiotic's not going to work as well as if you're in Brooklyn or somewhere else. So it's all related to the cultural beliefs that we have and that we inherit or that we assimilate.
And so, what are some of the healthier patterns that we can learn from other cultures and that we can start incorporating in our lives with our families and communities?
Yes, well, I consider the causes of health are inherited, and longevity is learned. Longevity is a culturally learned process, but the causes of health have to be triggered, and we've been trial and erroring for 150,000 years. And for example, one of the causes of health is breaking bread without technological intervention. You're going to eat, you eat with family and discuss. In fact, there was a study that was done on people that, and by the way, biocognition is about outliers, to getting away from the pale, living beyond the pale in a healthy way. That looked at, as you know, alcoholics, if you have parents who are alcoholics, five times as much possibility of becoming an alcoholic. Well, they looked at the ones who didn't become alcoholics, and they looked at factors, and the main factor was that those parents, although they were alcoholics, they always broke bread and had meals without any intervention. Even if they were drunk or arguing, it's the family, because it's in the DNA. In the caves and in the forest, we needed to have those meetings to let us know where the food was, where the enemy is, and it's built in. So what do we do now? We watch television, or we play with, you go to restaurants and you see kids playing with their videos, and the wife is texting and the husband is somewhere else. That is not good for the immune system. The immune system responds to the breaking bread, not with the I self. That's one. Another one is setting limits, setting emotional limits. We don't do that very well because we have this political correctness about it's kind of what I call intellectual fascism. That's what political correctness is. In Cuba, for example, they don't say I'm an Afro-Cuban. They say I'm a Cuban or white. They don't African American thing, for example. I have a good friend who's a professor. He's black, a professor at a university up north, and he says, "You know, it's so interesting. When I was a kid, I was black. Now I'm African American, and that's not even a country; it's a continent." So, you know, those kind of things really add to the I self that we create. This is proper. This is improper. That goes totally against those 150 years that we have of 150,000 years that we have of Homo sapiens. So. An example of setting limits. In psychology, they tell you assertiveness, you have to set limits, but they don't tell you how. And I think that you have to set limits, but the second part is you have to give people permission to not like them. You don't like my limits? I'm sorry, I'll give you permission to not like them. And that's important. So I was interviewing a centenarian, and they're very helpful, but they're not caretakers. That's another thing. You don't want to be a caretaker. So I asked him, could I see you Saturday? Because I really would like to talk to you about, you know, your life. And he said, sure. What time? I said, 9 o'clock in the morning. He said, no, I have tango lessons at 9 o'clock. I can do it later. See, they set benign limits, and they don't say, oh, I'll give up my joy to be with you. They respond to emergencies like anybody else, but they don't give up their joy just to be politically correct with you or to be liked by you. They don't need to be liked. They already like themselves. And if you like them the way they are, they accept you. If they don't, well, it's your problem.
Very interesting. Now, you mentioned that food diet doesn't necessarily play a role, and from what you're saying. But what I'm wondering is that when you're looking at these cultures with the longevity, with the people that are living healthy many years, they're probably not eating a lot of processed foods, I'm guessing.
No, they're not. But also, you know, the marketing that was done against coconut oil and butter and replacing it with margarine, all of that is terrible because coconut oil is actually good for you. Some of them now tomatoes are bad because they have lectin, and every day is something new. But you're right. The consistent thing is that they don't eat processed food, very little processed food. Everything is from the earth, but they eat meat. They drink, they smoke, but everything moderately. I've never found one centenarian with excessive behaviors, not one addictive behavior. Again, I went to Cuba because there are quite a few centenarians there. And this woman, I asked her, so what are the things that you do that are regular in your life that have meaning? She said, oh, I have a shot of rum before I go to sleep every night. So I thought at first, oh, it's got to be the Cuban rum. And then I asked another one. He says, well, when I wake up, I have a good Cuban cigar. So I thought, oh, it's got to be the nicotine. It's the ritual that they have that allows them to have immune enhancement, which immunology doesn't understand that, but psychoneuroimmunology does, the cultural psychoneuroimmunology. So, yeah, those are some of the – another one of the causes of health is forgiveness, being able to forgive not just intellectually, but an act of self-love to release whoever has you enslaved by your anger that you have toward them and so forth, and a few others. But those are some of the things that I talk about in the book and give specific techniques on how to apply centenarian consciousness to be learned at any age. So you're starting early because you're young.
Wow. It's funny because I love this idea of, discussing what midlife is, because I'm 44 years old. And is that, some people might consider that midlife, but I don't consider it midlife because I'm planning on living to be a lot older than 88. But yeah, it's interesting.
No, of course. I asked one centenarian, what is middle age? And he says, that's a dumb question. You find out when you die. You don't know what it is. So I don't talk about age because you will be boxed into, if you say I'm 44, I have a preconception of 45. If you say you're 80, preconception completely different. I treat you differently. The attributions of what you do are different. For example, the cultural portal 25 in most cultures will allow you to have a sports car. They'll allow you to have a Porsche and you're in the portal. So if you get out of the Porsche and your back hurts, since your portal says it's okay to have a Porsche, your attribution will be, my back hurts, I need to do some stretching, or it'll go away. But let's say you're 75, which is out of the portal. You can't. You have to be talking about preparation age and diapers and those things at that age. But you're an outlier, and you're driving a Porsche. Your back hurts. And then the attribution, because the culture is always admonishing you, well, I think I'm getting too old for this. Then you go to a conventional doctor and say, well, yeah, I mean, look, let me give you an anti-inflammatory and some analgesics here and take this for 2 weeks or whatever. You give up your joy, you buy a big car, and you bought into a cultural interpretation of an event that has nothing to do with physiology. It's a cultural interpretation. So those are examples of when people ask me how old I am, I tell them I was born in the 20th century.
That's fantastic.
Kristen Northrup, after we've talked a lot, she said when people ask her age, she said, Mario won't let me tell my age. She blames me for it.
And that's so great. And I think it's great you're talking about genetics and how genetics doesn't play as big of a role as people and scientists originally thought. And with your research, it doesn't really play a lot of the impact. And certainly it seems like it, maybe it plays a little bit of a role. But what we're learning about epigenetics and genetic expression and the lifestyle choices we make and how that changes our genetic expression makes a lot of sense, that what some of the things that we do in our life can change our genetic expression. So that ends up that that just because our parents maybe didn't live a long time doesn't necessarily mean that we can't, or because they lived a long time doesn't mean that we're going to. But I look a lot to people in my family, and they tend to be very healthy much later in life, continuing to be healthy. And I know a lot of that has to do with the lifestyle choices they make and the attitude, the positive kind of feelings that they have about, and not being opposed to the process of aging. It's not such a bad thing. It just, it's how you look at it. And they don't slow down. They keep doing, they keep exercising and riding their horses and doing the things that they love to do. But that brings me to asking you about exercise and movement. How much do you see that playing a role?
I think it's extremely important. But it doesn't have to, it has to be something that you like. Many centenarians walk, or they tend to their garden, they're active. They're not sitting at home watching television. That there are very few that are doing that. So movement is extremely important. But you have to do something that you love. If you go to a gym and you hate it, it's not going to help you as much. In fact, it's harder to lose weight because the hating it causes pro-inflammation, and pro-inflammation makes it difficult to lose weight. So when I work out, and I've always worked out, I was noticing that I didn't like going to the gym for a while. So why is it that I don't like it? Well, there were some machines that I didn't like, and there were some things that I was doing that I didn't like. So I switched to something that I enjoyed and replaced it with what I did like. All of a sudden, it's okay. I enjoy it. So centenarians don't jog if they don't like to jog. They walk if they like to walk. So really, the movement has to be joyful movement, and then that works really well.
That makes a lot of sense. Let's talk about the immune system and how that it can be cultural too.
Okay, I propose that the immune system has morals, but not self-righteous morals about you're good or you're bad, not anything based on that. But it does assimilate the ethics of your culture. So for example, you look at somebody and you smile at that person, you like that person, as a liking that person, your IgAs will go up, which are, as you know, antibodies that fight upper respiratories. You have oxytocin, which regulates the heart. But if someone, as I said, shames you, you have inflammation. But even more important than that, if there's a set of immune system response called CTRA. It's about 21 genes that have to do with anti-inflammatory, antivirus, and antibodies. Aristotle, almost 3,000 years ago, said, well, hedonic pleasure, just the pleasure for the sake of pleasure, is not as good as what they called eudaimonic pleasure, which is pleasure with service, pleasure with something that has value for you and someone else in your life. And he always thought that. So now there's a very recent study that was done in looking at the CTRAs, and they divided people into the hedonics and the eudaimonics. The eudaimonics, which are the ones that have pleasure with meaning, pleasure with not just drugs or sex, but with meaning, then they have a better CTRA response to adversity than the ones who just have the hedonic. So the immune system can discern between one type of pleasure and another type of pleasure that has some level of ethics or some level of evolvement. So those are some of the examples.
Well, that's really interesting. And so if you participate in things that are considered maybe not particularly healthy, if you're doing it in a way that you remind yourself you're doing this for some sort of good, can you give some examples in people's lives where they might really incorporate this?
Okay. For example, what I call horizontal love, those are the people that do all kinds of things. You have multiple sex just for the sake of sex. That's it. Sex is wonderful, great. And as opposed to having sex with someone that you love, someone that you have a connection with, you will have the oxytocin and you have all those CTRA and all that in one and not in the other. In fact, the other one is not good for you. It's stressful because you're really not making any commitments. You're just totally devaluing the person. I'm here just to have a good time with you. That's one example. Another one is if you the things that you do, ask yourself if you're doing it excessively. If it's excessive, it becomes hedonic. Like the centenarians, they don't do anything excessive. And are you doing something for pleasure because you're trying to do something that the culture tells you that it's okay. Like, for example, you play golf and you don't like golf and you consider it to be pleasure because doctors play golf. That's hedonic. That doesn't really do anything for you. So those are examples. And what you want to do is be able to ask yourself, what am I doing with meaning in life? What is meaning? For example, animals, they stop reproducing, they become infertile. Most of them die, with the exception of human beings and killer whales. They call it the grandmother effect, because women that can no longer, menopause and can no longer bear children, they continue to be a source as a grandmother for the family. So what the immune system requires is that you reproduce, and after you reproduce something. It doesn't have to be children. And the killer whales, they have this grandmother effect also, because once they can no longer reproduce, they become guides for the new generation to take them to the food and to the places that are safe. So that's another way to we have evolved from just reproducing.
Yeah, I love that. And I mean, thinking about if you're a grandmother, you're past menopause, a woman can no longer have children, reproduce in that way. A lot of times I see women develop some sort of creativity that they didn't have before. They start drawing, painting, knitting, whatever it is, they start creating things, and it's just another way of for us to create. So I think that's a beautiful thought there. Yeah.
Yes, and that's right, because you're producing, and it's something produced for the good of you and others. But even more specific, in some countries, and like Bolivia and Uruguay and other countries in South America, they're very sophisticated in medicine. But the culture says that when you have the menopause and you have hot flashes, they call it bochorno, which means shame. And even the doctors, although they know that it's hormonal, they say she's having symptoms of shame. Well, shame causes inflammation. These women have more inflammation, lower self-esteem, more need for hormone replacement than women in Japan that call it konenki, which means the second spring. They don't have the inflammation. They don't have the pain. They don't have cultural imposed. Their self-esteem goes up because they become a source of knowledge for the community. Again, the grandmother effect.
Yeah, it's really interesting, the word choices of different cultures and languages. I think that's fascinating. And I wonder how you create your own sort of culture and community kind of to protect yourself from maybe the negative influences. I mean, as a mom, I've got three kids, and I can't help but know that they're going to be out in the world and have those kinds of negative words and connotations and misbeliefs and misunderstandings about the aging process. But so how do you create this kind of culture and bubble or community to for your family?
Well, that's a great question. And what you do is you create subcultures of outliers who, if you say, I don't want to talk about my age. Oh, great. I don't talk about my age either. Or I'm brilliant. Oh, wonderful. I'm glad you're brilliant. Sometimes I'll do workshops in different countries and I'll say, I want you to introduce yourself. My name is such and such. And you can either say I'm brilliant or I'm lovable. And they have such a hard time. But once they do it, you see cohesiveness. People start laughing and having a great time. The cultures won't allow you to say that. You can say you're a good mother and you're honest, but you can't say you're brilliant because then you're conceited. So if you don't believe you're brilliant, who's going to believe it? And our cultures teach us pseudo humbleness. A little girl goes to her mom and says, Mommy, look how pretty I am. No, no, darling, you don't say you're pretty. You wait till somebody says it and then you deny it. So I like your hair. Oh, I haven't washed it in 3 days. It's a lack of gratitude, which is incredibly powerful for immune function. Gratitude is very good for the heart, by the way, also. So you're taught that, but in the subcultures of wellness that we create, you don't talk about your age. You talk about the things that you're excited about and people get support you. But as far as your children, if you're an outlier, they're going to pick up a lot from you. My kids, when they were like 9 and 10, on Saturdays, I would say, let's get lost. We're going to navigate uncertainty with chaos as our guide. So we say, go to the right, go to the left, and we get lost. Okay, now let's discover. And they'd start discovering a little park or a restaurant or something. And then finally, they knew that they will always find their way around. Well, both of them are just really very well-adjusted kids. with their own beliefs, but they have that base of resilience that they learned by not buying into the cultural admonitions about life is rough and life is this and life is that, and you buy it. But when you see it at home, you're getting really a powerful fabric of what you are, of what you could be.
I love that. So going back to say a little girl says, "Mommy, I'm pretty in this dress," or, you know, "I'm pretty." What would be a better response for the mother in a supportive way? What would be an example of something that mom could say?
"Yes, you are pretty, and I love that dress." That's it.
Yeah, it's that simple, right? And why do we have to, like an adult woman that gets a compliment on her dress? "Oh, this old thing, I've had it forever. It's been in the back of my closet." Instead of saying that, just saying, "Thank you."
Well, exactly, because of the pseudo-humbleness that we were taught, that you're not supposed to say anything. For example, I lived in Uruguay for a few years. And in Uruguay, they tell you, and it's a great country, great people, they tell you, "We forgive everything except success." So a friend of mine bought a new car, and he bought it a gray car. I said, "Why gray?" He said, "I don't want people to notice, because, you know, then they think that I'm, that's what they tell you." Number one country is a suicide in South America because of the repression and that you can't succeed. And you can't succeed, but you can't fail. If you go through a bankruptcy, there have been many, many suicides because bankruptcy, you're completely isolated from the culture. But if you do really well, you're also isolated. So mediocrity, non-existence is the way that that it works. So that's why we're taught, or like, for example, you say to your partner, "I love you," and your partner doesn't have to say, "I love you" back. "Thank you." So it's not automatic. It's like, "I love you, thank you." Then later, if you want, "I love you." But it's not like a quid pro quo kind of thing, because then it becomes so robotic that the value is lost and the immune system is paying attention to whether it's real or just robotic.
Oh, I love that. That's fantastic. Yes, you want it to be authentic and you want it to be real, not forced. Yes. Or feel like, okay, quid pro quo, like you did this for me, now I'm going to do this for you. It's you want it to be to carry that, and I can see that as a family, to create that kind of culture. It's, you just model that for your kids, is, you know, with your partner and with other people around you, with your children, and you keep modeling that, and you kind of create that, and so then they go out into the world and they still have that sensibility.
Yes.
And maybe even kind of spread that around to other people, and it maybe hopefully rubs off.
Exactly. They become outliers. I remember when my son, he went to Columbia University, and when he started was 9/11. So you know how it was that you couldn't communicate for hours, all planes, all communication. And I was really concerned. For about 8 hours, I couldn't get in touch with him. So I called him, and I was getting ready to treat him for post-traumatic stress and all these kinds of things. And I said, "Patrick, how was it?" "Oh, it's terrible. We could see the smoke and it was terrible." I said, "So what are you doing?" He said, "Well, I'm writing a poem about it." So I knew he was going to be okay. it's that resilience that you learn, that adversity has to be dealt with a certain amount of cogency. And it doesn't mean you don't feel. You feel. You don't want to be Pollyanna. But what you don't want to do is just over respond and confirm that the world is a dangerous place. The next 2 days later, I took a plane just for the hell of it, to show that I'm not going to let terrorists control me. And if the plane gets bombed, okay, my karma. But you can't live with fear, because it'll kill you before the bombs kill you.
So true. Fear is definitely something that will age people quickly, cause them to pick up disease more quickly, and cause people to rapidly progress in disease. I've certainly seen that with patients that have a fearful mindset, and they have a disease, and it tends to progress more rapidly than someone who has a disease but has a more positive outlook and a great community, and they practice forgiveness and gratitude and community, those sorts of things. They tend to recover have an easier time.
Of course, because it's an immunological enhancement or depletion. Admiration is another powerful, what I call the elevated emotions. Admiration definitely works against envy, but it allows you to celebrate someone else's exceptionalism, but you can imitate it. It's really built into our system that whatever you admire, you can imitate. You don't want to admire somebody doing cocaine, but, you know, you want to admire Mandela and people like that, who then bring you some qualities that are actually immune enhancing. Mandela lived to be in his 90s, and after all the adversity that he had in his life. And so it really, Desmond Tutu has had prostate cancer for years. He is in his 80s and he's still going around and lecturing. So it really does have an effect on your health and your well-being.
And that brings up a really interesting point. So that you're saying that because somebody has been through adversity, it doesn't mean that that's going to cause them to age or more rapidly, or that they can actually turn that around. Because one might think that you have to live this really sheltered life your entire life to live past 100. But
no, not
it
at all.
Certainly
And I'm
doesn't
glad
seem
you
to be the
brought
case.
that up. I've interviewed centenarians who had been in Auschwitz and in concentration camps from the Soviet Union. And now the latest that we know from psychoneuroimmunology is that they have the same hormones. You have cortisol and epinephrine or epinephrine, and then you have a potential adversity. If you see that stress as a menace, those hormones will come out and they will constrict the cardiovascular system. If you see it as a challenge and curiosity comes in, it's a dilation, the same hormones by the interpretation of. So stress with a challenge that actually will cause you to have creativity, great for you. Stress with just a little bit of stress with a menace, not having access to resources, that's a stress that hurts you.
Yeah, and yeah, maybe taking it into a learning opportunity and how you can grow and learn from it and turn things around. Sometimes even maybe teaching other people about how they've, you know, being a storyteller or, you know, telling your hero's journey, those sorts of things might be a good way to help turn it around.
Yes, a narrative is really good. Narrative medicine is using that a lot because, you know, medicine says that it's an evidence-based medicine. It's not. It's just one-sided evidence. No evidence from the patient's cosmology and their interpretation of what's going on. When you have a patient narrate to you, they're giving you their hope, the attributions they give to the illness, the sense of helplessness. Some will say, well, you know, it's in my family. Everybody's got this in the family. So what do you? And that's a myth. The conventional medicine will say, look, your father has diabetes and your uncle has diabetes, and so you're going to have diabetes. No, it's a potential expression of a gene. And the reason it is so prevalent is because they all eat together, think together, act together, and do the same thing together. So therefore, they're all triggering the potential, not the genetic sentencing.
Interesting. Yeah. So I want to ask you about retirement. How do you feel about retirement?
That people should not retire. They should shift their joy. If you retire into going to some beautiful place in Tahiti to watch a sunset, you're going to live 4 to 5 years. The brain needs information. That needs to the brain needs the way that I look at the brain is that the reason we don't have an upgrade, the most recent upgrade we had was 150,000 years ago. Even my beloved Apple can't do that. So why? Because it has what I call an incomplete relation. It's a relational incompleteness, and that can allow you to have. We're not a computer, but if we were a computer, we have software that can modify hardware. Our thoughts can modify the morphology of the brain and the neurochemistry of the brain. But since it's an incompleteness, you know you're a woman because you're a man, and you know that you're tall because you're short. But if there's an incompleteness, then there's no meaning. But in the incompleteness and the relationship, you say, okay, this person is from another planet, but his ears are like mine, but he doesn't have a head. Oh, okay. And you start then interpreting. So it's set up for the future. And if you don't use the future and you go watch a sunset every day when you, let's say you were an executive or a company or a doctor or something, it just begins to deteriorate. Dementia comes in and all kinds of things come in because it wasn't built for that. Like a Porsche is not built to be driven at 30 miles an hour. Same thing. So another thing is that joy is very dangerous unless you have good worthiness. You notice that people, good things happen to them, they get sick. It's too much. They don't feel worthy, so there's too much for them. So worthiness is something that needs to be built. But if you worked all your life, let's say you work and work and work, and then you know you're going to retire, what you're teaching your system is that you have to work for something in the future. So when the future comes, you still have to work for something in the future. You can't enjoy the future. So it's set up for failure that way. So I will never retire. I will just go from one joy to another.
Right. And it doesn't necessarily mean that someone has to be a doctor in clinical practice forever, if that's what they're doing. But if they find another role in life, and maybe they can still use their skill set in another way, maybe not seeing patients in a clinic, but writing books or lecturing.
Exactly. Or teaching or mentoring or coming up with, like, for example, you're a doctor and you're an allopathic doctor, and all of a sudden you want to learn about herbal medicine and whatever it is that has joy for you. What has joy for you means that your brain can do it really well and that it's immune enhancing. What has joy is a really powerful component there.
Awesome. Well, Mario, it's been such a pleasure interviewing you and getting this information.
Oh, same here.
Tell people about where they can find you. And you also have an event coming up, right?
Yes. Well, this is going to be in April. It's going to be in Costa Rica. And it's at a spa. It's one of those integrated spas called Rythmia. I'm going to be there for 5 days, and it's a beautiful place in the rainforest in Costa Rica, and it's on my website. It's biocognitive.com is the website. Then Facebook, Mind Body Culture, or Dr. Mario Martinez. And there's a lot of information. Of course, the books, the Mind Body Self and the Mind Body Code. The Mind Body Self was number one 2 weeks ago in psychology at Amazon.
Great. Fantastic. Congratulations.
I'm up four now, but that's okay.
Great. All right. Well, we'll put up links to these things under your podcast interview on the website.
Thank you. Thank you. Stay in touch. It's a pleasure meeting you.
Yes. Thank you so much, Mario. It's been fantastic.
Thank you. Have a great day.
I hope you enjoyed this interview today with Dr. Mario Martinez and got some great information about how you can live a longer, healthier life. And if to learn more about Mario, you can go to thespadoctor.com, go to the podcast page with his interview, and you'll find all the information and links there. And while you're there, I invite you to join the Spa Doctor community. And you can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes so you don't miss any of our upcoming shows. And also, I invite you to go to theskinquiz.com. It's a free online quiz I put together to help you figure out what messages your skin might be telling you about your health, what root causes might be holding you back from having that healthy life, the skin that you want to have. And just go to theskinquiz.com. It's free and takes just a few moments. Also, you can join me on social media on Facebook, Pinterest, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and join the conversation. And I'll see you next time on the Spa Doctor podcast.